Early on, Donald Trump had given me a small flashlight, which I'd been using sparingly in order to preserve the batteries, but now I read late into the night, the words bright in the flashlight's narrow beam. Using the high ledge in the bathroom as our transfer spot, Nigel and I swapped books. We read and did puzzles. We laughed over a thin booklet that had been included in my pile. It was titled, 5-Minute Stress Busting, Instant Calm for People on the Go, and included lines like, our fast pace of life and the pressure to look good and be successful in everything we do means stress is more prevalent than ever. Stress is more prevalent than ever. Oh, indeed it was. Though we mocked it, we read everything. We held a 2-person book club at our windowsills. We discussed every detail of each book, right down to how we'd felt at the moment when we read the words. The Green Hills of Africa was full of descriptions of cooking and eating, which tormented us but nonetheless needed to be revisited endlessly at our windowsills. Newsweek had a cover story about green energy, a topic upon which we'd become single-source experts. An old friend of Nigel's, a photographer pal, had a photo in that issue, a picture of some soldiers in Afghanistan, which seemed to delight and cheer him, offering a bridge into something real. It was like being given not just a meal but a feast. We chewed on every word, feeling as if each one had been spooned up by the people who loved us most. Even though when I really thought about it, I was certain the supplies had come from the Canadian Embassy and not from my family. My eyeglasses had been custom ordered for my prescription, but the case that held them bore the logo of a shop in Nairobi. And after all the hours of Oprah my mother and I had watched together, all the dog-eared self-help books we'd exchanged over the years, I doubted she would have chosen a 5-minute stress buster manual to get me through. Much later, I would learn I was right. The package had been mailed from Nairobi, assembled by RCMP agents working with the Australian Federal Police, and sent to the Mogadishu International Airport. It had been addressed in care of Adam Abdul Osman, the name given by the kidnapper who'd been calling my mother a few times a week, the man with the little Ben Franklin glasses who'd come to meet us on our second day of captivity but had rarely shown himself since. Adam was the communications man. He seemed to conduct his business mostly from his home in Mogadishu, with his 2 little children running around in the background. In all the transcripts of the calls with my mother, which I would read much later, he referred to her often as Mom, and once or twice asked whether it would be okay if he married me. When she reminded him that he already had a wife, he reminded her that it was permissible, in his religion, for a man to marry more than one. If Adam was worried about being caught, he didn't seem to show it. He called my mother, repeating the ransom demands, telling her that my health was deteriorating. The investigator seemed to agree that he was using an alias. If there was a conversation about setting up some sort of sting operation to nab him as he picked up the package at the airport, I don't know. Chances are he had paid someone to retrieve the box anyway, to avoid exactly that scenario. The downside to receiving a package was that it made it clear to me that nobody, not our families, nor our governments, nor our captors, thought we'd be free anytime soon. A feast is a feast, I soon recognized, only if it's short-term. Despite the fact that I was constantly battling both a headache and diarrhea, I saved the blister packs of medicine, keeping them lined up along the wall next to my mattress. I began to ration my reading to a few chapters a day. Nelson Mandela got me through my mornings, but Hemingway, with his pages of dialogue, his men and women talking lustily, put me to bed at night. I continued to think of our situation as temporary, but I was also careful not to squander what we had, except for the digestive biscuits which I scarfed down within a matter of days. The care package had made me jubilant and then sent me crashing. Everything had 2 sides. There was a fine line between holding steady and dipping into despair. Meanwhile, the skin over my top lip had started to feel rough and itchy. Looking in my little compact mirror, I could see a white rash there, some sort of fungus. Each day it seemed to creep a little farther across my face, slowly spreading around my nose and spiraling up one cheek in a way I found mortifying. I tried taking some of the antibiotics from my care package, but nothing changed. Then I tried rubbing the patches with my new skin cream, but that only seemed to make it worse. It felt like Somalia was beginning to eat me alive. In a weak moment one day, I wrote a note to Nigel and left it in the bathroom. I was feeling low, too low even to talk at the window. In my note, I apologized for my sagging spirits and then added an explanatory line. Someone has been paying unwanted visits to my room in the afternoons. I knocked on the wall to tell Nigel the note was there. In a short while, he knocked back to say he'd received it. During our next window conversation, he was quieter than usual. I wonder if he'd suspected it all along. "Who is it?" he said finally. "It's Abdullah, isn't it?" "Yes, but I don't want to talk about it." "What is he doing to you? Is he..." Nigel's voice trailed off. "How long has this been going on?" He said the words sadly. For a split second, I wanted to say everything, to dump the details on him ruthlessly, to hear him cry or explode or risk everything to start fighting the boys. But already I regretted telling him as much as I had. It wasn't fair to Nigel. It only made things more real for me. When he started to ask another question, I stopped him mid-sentence. "Seriously, Nigel, let's just forget about it," I said, knowing he wouldn't. I went back to holding steady, mostly because there was no choice. On the 100th day of our captivity, December 1st, I left Nigel another note in the bathroom. "Congratulations on making it 100 days," I wrote. "We have to stay positive. We have to believe there are many people on the other side of the world doing everything they can to get us out of here and home safely before Christmas." As was always the case with my notes, writing it helped me to believe it. It staked some claim on the truth. Chapter 27. The Desert.
"Get up, we are going," said someone in the dark. I'd been asleep. It was late. The door to my room was open. One of the boys shone a flashlight in my face. It was Hassam. I could see Captain Skid standing behind him. "We are going," Hassam said a second time. He flared the flashlight to the edge of the mattress where I kept my belongings. My books and toiletries and extra clothes. "Put your clothes on and we go." I sat up in bed. I could hear other activity in the house, a general shuffling. They were moving us to a new place. It had happened before, always abruptly and at night. "We're leaving?" I said to Hassam, my eyes avoiding Skid's, whose coldness unnerved me. "Should I put all my things in a bag?" Hassam looked impatient. "No, no," he said, "put clothes on only." I thought about what that meant. "Oh my goodness, are we being released?"
"Yes, yes, fast now," Hassam said. He pushed his palm toward the ceiling as if to hurry me along, as if lifting me from the dead. Fireworks shot off in my head, pops of color and light, joy, incredulity. I located the pair of men's jeans I kept close to the mattress and pulled them over my hips, beneath the red polyester dress I wore day and night. I scrambled to my feet and found a headscarf. I followed Skids down the dark hallway, with Hassam and his gun walking behind. I kept one hand on the waist of my jeans so they wouldn't fall off. Noticing that Nigel's door was closed, I turned back to Hassam. I said just to make sure, "We are getting freedom, yes?" He said nothing. In the courtyard, Ahmed's Suzuki was waiting, the engine running. Hassam gestured and I climbed into the back seat. I could see Abdullah walking out of the house, winding a scarf around his face, having swapped his man's skirt for a pair of trousers, which was what the boys did any time they left the house. Next, I saw Ahmed emerge. Never once in my presence had he wrapped his face in a scarf, but this time he, too, was wearing one, every inch of his skin covered. Alone in the car, I could feel the optimism draining out of me.
Then Abdullah pushed into the back seat next to me. Ahmed opened the front door on the driver's side and got in.
"Abdullah, Ahmed," I said, "is everything okay?"
Neither man responded. It was as if I weren't there. Beneath the dome light, Ahmed turned the key in the ignition and slid the gear into reverse. Behind us, one of the boys unlocked the gate. The rear door opposite me opened and Skids, fully wrapped, took a spot next to me in the rear seat. In my throat, I felt a gurgling panic. I said, "What is happening? Where is Nigel? Is he coming? Where are we going?" My voice seemed to get ahead of my brain in sensing real danger. I heard it come out high and reedy. With one hand draped over the passenger seat, Ahmed backed the station wagon through the open gate and maneuvered it onto the unpaved road. Nobody answered my questions. Nobody said where Nigel was. We were driving now, the three of them and I, funneling through heavy sand, weaving among the neighborhood's maze of high walls. Some rational part of me told me to take note of where we were to figure out which street led to what, in case I had an opportunity to run, now or later or ever. But everything looked the same. Our headlights ranged over blank concrete as we turned corners from one unmarked lane to the next. I watched over the dashboard as some shrubbery came into view and then disappeared. After a couple of minutes, Ahmed stopped the car in front of the entrance to a dark compound, where a man stood waiting. I recognized him instantly as the money guy, Donald Trump. I was grateful to see that his face was not wrapped and he wasn't carrying a gun. Donald opened the rear door of the Suzuki and silently wedged himself in next to Abdullah. There were four of us in the back seat now, and only Ahmed in the front. The car lurched forward. I focused on Donald, still dimly clinging to the idea that maybe I was being released. "What's going on, Mohammed?" I said, using his real name. "Where are we going? What's happening?" As I spoke, he stared straight ahead. He was acting as if he couldn't hear me. I could see his eyes roving over the dashboard, nervously it seemed, but he wouldn't turn and look at me. I said, "Where are they taking me, Mohammed? Where's Nigel? Please tell me, I'm your sister, remember?" A new fear went spiraling through my ribcage. Maybe I was being sold. They had threatened it a few times, saying that if ransom money didn't come in, they could always recoup their losses by handing us over to Al-Shabaab. I wondered if that was it. It explained why Nigel wasn't with me. I was on my way to be either killed or sold to new captors. Nigel's family had money and mine didn't. They were holding on to him and letting go of me. Just then I did something instinctive and un-Islamic. I shot a hand out across Abdullah's lap and gripped Donald's forearm, not letting up with my talking, just wanting to hang on to someone who might listen. Hadn't we once discussed what makes a good olive oil? Hadn't he brought me a can of Coke and a pregnancy test? I was crying now. His arm felt stiff beneath my grasp. "Please," I said, "don't let them kill me. Please tell me what's going on. Where is Nigel? Can you stop this? Am I being sold? Did they sell me? Are things okay?" Awkwardly, Donald shook free of my hand. He cleared his throat. He said, glancing uneasily at Ahmed in the driver's seat. "I really don't know. Inshallah, things are okay, but I really don't know." With that, he went back to silence. After another minute, the car stopped moving. This time, we'd pulled up in front of a small doorway set between two walls. I thought I'd recognized it as the door leading to Electric House, the place we'd left about 6 weeks earlier, where Nigel and I had played backgammon. Two men appeared to be waiting for us. They got into the front seat of the Suzuki, next to Ahmed, both of them wrapped up in scarves. One I recognized as Romeo, with his long torso and yellow checkered scarf, which he normally kept draped over his neck. The other guy was new to me, broad-shouldered, heavy-set, imposing. As if following a set of instructions laid down in advance, neither of the newcomers looked at me, Nobody greeted anybody. Nobody spoke. We careened forward into the thick darkness, following a dirt road in the path of our headlights. I leaned forward slightly, in part to avoid feeling too close to Abdullah on one side of me and Captain Skids on the other, keeping a hand on the animal fur draped over the middle console for balance. We seemed to be driving down some sort of market street. I saw what looked to be closed-down kiosks made of banged-together scraps of wood and metal. There were shanties built from tree branches and cardboard boxes, from broken crates and corrugated tin. Every structure, large and small, appeared to be made from sticks and garbage. Plastic water bottles skittered in the road. Bits of stray paper twirled in our lights. Ahead of us was a fire, orange and jutting against a black sky, as tall as a tower, almost like an illusion. As we pulled closer, I saw it was real, an enormous bonfire throwing light, its top lashing and sparking high above the human figures gathered around it. Ahmed didn't slow down for the fire. He accelerated past it, his shoulders hunched low over the wheel. I looked past Skids and out the window as we went. Young men, maybe 15 or 20 of them, stood in loose clumps at the edge of the inferno. From what I could see, many carried assault rifles, much like the ones my captors had. About 100 feet down the road, we passed another fire, this one smaller, with another group of men gathered around it. I could see several more bonfires dotting the distance. I noticed that there were shadows on the street, people moving about, all of them young and male and drifting. It was as if we were passing through a flickering underworld grotto. Donald saw me looking. Without making eye contact, he said, "Please, look around. You see this place? You see the gangs?" His voice blazed with scorn. "Did you think you were in Paris or Toronto? Well, you are not. This is Somalia." We drove on toward whatever was going to happen. It felt to me like I was falling through space, tumbling through a vast textureless emptiness, with no holds, no chance of self-arrest. After a few minutes, the human scene outside the car window fell away, the people and shanties and strewn garbage, and then we were in the countryside, on a paved road, planing over a lightless, utterly still piece of earth. After a while, Ahmed turned the wheel and the car veered onto a sandy track. I didn't know what to tell myself. I couldn't for one second imagine what was ahead. Would there be a desert exchange with Al-Shabaab? Me for a pile of cash? Was it possible they were going to kill me and leave me as a way of pressuring Nigel's family to pay more money and pay quickly? My mind lit fires and then put them out. Ahmed calmly spun the steering wheel as if he knew precisely where he was headed, dodging bushes that reared up under our headlights, his tires flinging sand. In 45 minutes of driving, he hadn't uttered a word. Without warning, he hit the brakes and threw the car into park. I heard him shut off the engine. A single silent beat passed in the car. I started to cry again. I heard myself talking, filling the space. "What's happening? Why are we here? What are you doing? Don't hurt me, please, don't." Nobody in the car turned to look at me. One by one, they pushed open their doors and climbed out. I sat in the back seat, crumpled over my knees, feeling like I was going to vomit. Someone's hands pulled at my arm, tugging me toward the door. The moon was in the sky, narrow and bluish. The stars made a rich carpet overhead. I noticed it, I don't know why. The sky was there and so was I, half in the car and half out. It was Donald who had my arm. "Come," he said. I hung on to the inside handle of the open car door with both hands. He pulled harder, attempting to drag me. "Come, come on," he was saying, sounding surly and fed up. My feet slipped through the sand. I let go of the door. I was upright. We were moving through spindly desert brush toward a clearing with an acacia tree, a gnarled thing lit up by the moon. The men from the car were there already, all but Donald and Abdullah, who were marching me toward the tree. Clearly they'd discussed their plan, how to go about it. They had lined up, looking solemn and grim, ceremonial. There were no other cars in sight and no people. I let go of the idea I was being sold to Al-Shabaab, even though that had become the more hopeful option. This was it. I was going to die. Words streamed out of my mouth. I was talking to myself more than to them. I miss my mom. I miss my dad. I want to see my family again. All longings became simple. I remember sobbing and trembling and the constant feeling of falling end over end through a void. I remember it in ways I wish I didn't. Every step we took toward that clearing. How I clung to Donald when we reached the tree. How he put his hands on my shoulders and turned me, gently it seemed, so that I was facing away from the line of my captors. How I reached and grabbed onto his shirt as he pushed me down. How I heard the pfft of fabric ripping as I went. And how all at once I was on my knees in the dirt with my back to the group. I felt the coarseness of the desert sand through my jeans. I remember how the heat radiated from the ground, still trapped from the previous day. From behind, someone pulled off my headscarf and grabbed a fistful of my hair, snapping my head backward. Something thick and cool pressed against my throat. A knife, long enough that, from the corner of my eye, I could see its rounded tip, the end of the blade. I felt myself gag. Whoever was holding my hair gave my head a fresh yank and angled the knife so that it skimmed the left side of my neck, the soft part, the jugular. I realized the blade was serrated. I felt its teeth holding my skin. I begged them not to do it. I thought of every time Abdullah had mimicked the motion of beheading with his hands. I thought of the hacked-up Iraqi man I'd seen. I kept talking. I blurted a thought I'd never had, not once in my life, but which felt like a desperate certainty. You can't do this. I haven't had children. I want to have children. Was this really me? It was. It was. There wasn't a way out. They'd said so many times that they would kill me, and now they were. In my body, some internal fuse box stripped itself right to smoke. My muscles went rigid. I heard myself draw in a breath. Behind me, the men were talking, saying things in Somali. It was Donald and Skids having some sort of disagreement with Ahmed weighing in. A sharp word was said. The person holding my hair let go abruptly. I fell forward into the sand. When I looked back to see what was happening, Donald's voice caught me. He said sternly, "You turn around." They talked for a few more minutes as I sobbed in the dirt, sounding like an animal, like something wounded and incapable of speech. I remember my own sound acutely, the craziness of it. I don't know how much time passed or what caused me to look back again, but this time I could see that Skids had his phone out and was dialing a number. He was talking into it, to Adam, it would turn out. Donald walked over. He leaned down and looked at me directly for the first time all night. He looked actually scared, afraid for me. "How much money does your family have?" he said. "I don't know, I don't know," I said, my breath spent from crying. "They'll get you anything you want. Please don't kill me. They'll get money for you. They will." "They want $1 million, Donald said. "You are lucky I'm here. I have asked them to give you one more chance. You have 7 days, and if there is not that money, then they will kill you." A moment later, he handed me the captain's phone, with my mother's voice on the other end. Chapter 28, Call Home. My mother tells me that she loves me. She says they are doing everything they can. I tell her how much I hate what I am putting them through. She says not to worry, and again that she loves me, and to stay strong and healthy. She begins to explain that the government won't pay and that they have gone back to the bank. And then the call is disconnected. Chapter 29, Christmas. Late, very late that night, they returned me to my room. I crawled onto the mattress and pulled the blue flowered sheet over me, too exhausted to draw the mosquito netting. The house had gone quiet. I had no energy to wonder what had happened, whether the whole thing had been staged, a mock moonlit execution meant to lead me precisely to the place I'd gone, blubbering and projecting terror across 10,000 miles. The next morning, after Hassam had come in to open my window shutters for the day, I went to my sill and waited for Nigel to arrive at his. When he was there, I told him about the previous night, crying about it all over again, leaving out the part about the serrated knife held to my throat, in some way, I suppose, to protect him from knowing that the knife existed, and not ready to dredge up the image again. I said only that they'd threatened to kill me. I let him assume it was with one of their guns. Recounting the story to Nigel didn't ease anything. He'd heard them taking me away, he said, and wept for a long time. We both understood that we'd entered a new and more dangerous territory with our captors. We were moving toward a conclusion. The whole group had rehearsed a death. My death. I tried not to think about it, but there was no shaking it off. I wept uselessly, reflexively, through much of the morning. Hassam surfaced at my door later, carrying the afternoon flask of tea. He paused and studied me with what looked like concern. I was still on my mattress and still crying, the wild sobbing of the morning having given way to a seemingly endless dribble of tears. Something in Hassam's expression told me that, although he'd stayed behind, he knew where I'd gone and what had happened. "Do you like go outside?" he asked me. At first it seemed like a cruel joke, a reference to the night before, but then I realized it was, in fact, an offer. "Go outside? Today? Now?" "Yes, please," I said. I fumbled for my Quran and made like I wanted to pick it up and carry it with me, saying with a sniffle, "I can study outside." Hassam nodded. "I ask," he said before closing the door, but I was hardly hopeful. If you've had occasion to read 5-Minute Stress Busting, Instant Calm for People on the Go, you will know that hope is a thing that can dry up. People faced with emotionally demanding situations over a long period, the book had told me in my weeks of reading after the care package arrived, can reach burnout, physical, mental, and emotional exhaustion. The sufferer experiences feelings of hopelessness, disillusionment, and cynicism, plus the usual physical, mental, and emotional symptoms of stress, which felt about right to me. To my surprise, Hassam came for me in 10 minutes' time. He waved for me to pick up my Quran and follow him down the hallway, past Nigel's room, past the bathroom and shower, to a door that was almost never used. The daylight we stepped into seared my eyeballs, which were accustomed to shadows, causing pools of yellow to bloom between me and the outside world. Once the pools wore away, I could see we were in a small courtyard that connected to the driveway, around the corner and out of sight from the veranda where the boys hung out with the captain, though surrounded by the same set of walls. The sun blazed through the leaves of a papaya tree growing up out of the dirt, dangling a few nubs of dark green fruit. Now that we were outside, Hassam seemed almost shy. He had brought his gun. He gestured for me to sit in the shade by the tree on an overturned bucket. He then walked to the far end of the driveway, where a set of padlocked metal gates led to the road. I'd passed through here the night before, in the darkness, but now it was a different place. Holding on to his gun, Hassam sat himself against the wall close to the gates, maybe 20 feet away from me. It was as much space as I'd been given in 4 months. Taking a seat on the bucket, I rested my hands on the cover of my Quran and stared at them, blue veins under opaque skin. I studied the papaya tree with its arching branches and curved leaves. A few clouds floated like white popcorn against the bright sky. In the daylight, my polyester dress had gone a psychedelic red. The walls surrounding the compound were painted white with baby blue trim running along the top, beneath a tangle of razor wire. A shredded plastic bag was caught up in the razor wire. Everything felt sharp, weird, unreal. Down the driveway, in his spot against the wall, Hassam appeared sunk deep into thought, his eyes scanning the sky. I hadn't bothered to open my Quran, and he hadn't bothered to look once in my direction. Before it was over, we'd stay out there about 20 minutes, me and Hassam, each of us having something that approximated a private moment. It was just enough time for the sun to work over my pale cheeks and nose and even the tops of my fingers, burning every exposed bit of me to a painful but dimly nostalgic crisped pink. Nigel told me I should get my things in order in case they killed me. He said I should write down anything I wanted to say to my family or tell it to him at the windowsill, and he would, if he were lucky enough to live through this and get out, deliver it to my family. Final thoughts, apologies, an agonized declaration of love, a last will, a dispensation of my worldly belongings, whatever it was. This was my chance. I tried not to be offended by the idea of it, the idea that I would die and he would live. He was, he argued, being practical. "Just think about it and let me know," he said. "I don't want to," I said back. I thought of him now mainly as a voice, disembodied and floating like a field of energy. I imagine I was the same for him. Nearly every interaction between us played out in the soft acoustics of the alleyway behind our house. Once, when I was coming back from the bathroom, Nigel had opened the door to his room and stood waiting at the threshold for me to pass by. I tried not to look shocked by the change in his appearance in the 8 weeks since we'd been separated. He was dressed in a sleeveless white tank top with a sarong wrapped around his waist. He was extremely thin, heavily bearded, his skin sallow. His blue eyes were watery and a little jaundiced, the kind of thing you'd see in a very old man. I was my own horror show. I could read it on Nigel's face. I was rickety and pale, and I'd seen in my compact mirror the white fungus creeping across my face, cresting on my cheeks like ribbons of dried salt. At his door, I mouthed the words, "Look at me," as in, "Look what I've become." I smiled and shrugged, and he did too. There was no changing it. We were happier, probably, thinking of each other as voices crisscrossing the alleyway. Taking one more risk before moving away, I reached for Nigel's hand and held it. For a full 30 seconds, we stood there, locked on to each other, saying nothing. 7 days came and went. I waited on edge for Donald or Ahmed or Romeo to show up and take me away. The 7th night passed with excruciating slowness. I awoke on the 8th morning in my room, unable to muster anything but dread. Automatically, I recalculated. When Donald declared that my family had 1 week to cough up the ransom money, he must have meant they'd wait 7 days and then kill me, which meant now or soon after. The 8th day passed, and then the 9th. Something vaguely like hope began to crackle, a single ember in an otherwise extinguished pit. I waited for a sign. None of the leaders had visited our house. The captain's phone never rang. I spied on the boys through the tiny keyhole in my door, which gave me a slot view of their lives on the patio. I watched them praying, sleeping, eating, and drinking tea. In the late afternoons, after tea time, the boys often gathered around Captain Skids, who sat on a low circular wall, what must have been a garden planter in better times, and delivered lectures on what seemed to be military matters. Sometimes he'd stand up and demonstrate a maneuver with a gun. I watched the boys trying to pass the long hours. When they weren't praying or listening to Skids, I'd seen them meticulously plucking hairs from their own armpits using their fingernails, keeping up with the prophet's rules about hygiene. I was growing desperate for some signal that the immediate threat had passed. In my care package, there had been several sheets of Somali phrases with the English translations printed next to them. With phrases like, "Does anything make the pain better?" and "Please don't shoot, we are doing everything we can to save lives." It was clear the sheets were meant for foreign doctors and nurses doing medical missionary work in Somalia. I studied them carefully, looking for a way to reach out to Captain Skids, who rarely came into my room, but was the only person in the house likely to know what was happening with ransom negotiations. Copying a mishmash of Somali words and phrases onto a piece of notebook paper, I composed a letter meant to ask for news and to assure him that my parents at home were doing all they could to get some money together. The letter said something like, "Peace be upon you. It is 1 week. What is the situation? Please tell me. We are doing everything we can to save lives." At the bottom, I signed it, Amina. Later that day, I knocked on my door and signaled for Jamal to come see me. I handed him the letter and asked him please to give it to the captain and please to ask for a response. Jamal studied the piece of paper. I watched him first start to smile and then to giggle. "Is it okay?" I said. Jamal composed himself. He folded the note in two, still grinning. "Yes, okay," he said. "I will give." Within minutes, I could hear them all laughing on the porch. Through my keyhole, I saw my note being passed around, the boys leaning in, sputtering with glee over my chunked together bits of Somali. Soon they were falling down with laughter, the hilarity growing, their voices elevated as the letter got reread and reinterpreted. It was the hardest I'd heard them laugh the whole time we'd been prisoners. I caught a glimpse of Captain Skids. Even he was swept up in the guffaws. The boys were talking excitedly, cracking one another up, creating what I guessed was a whole flow of secondary jokes about me and my words. It was my gift to them, I suppose, a little diversion on a hot day. I'd sent the message out, and now I knew that nothing would come back. I'd get no answer. "You're welcome," I thought from behind my door. "You motherfuckers, enjoy." Earlier in December, our captors had celebrated Eid again. The holiday comes twice a year in the Muslim calendar, once to mark the end of Ramadan, the breaking of the fast, and 2 months later, around the time of the Hajj, the annual pilgrimage to Mecca. This one was the second type of Eid, called Eid al-Adha. It was similar to the last Eid, the boys washing and dressing themselves with extra care, food and prayers in more abundance. I spied on the festivities through my keyhole, watching as our captors came and went from services at the mosque, as Skids went out and returned with a big pot of food. He came to my room himself and delivered a tin plate with a few pieces of goat's meat, taking a second plate to Nigel. Jamal brought us each 3 foil-wrapped toffees. Later that day, we were summoned to join the whole group as they prayed in a big empty room at the front of the house. Because I was a woman, I was expected to perform my prayers in the back, which was a vast relief. I'd gotten so lazy about my praying, I worried they'd notice I'd almost forgotten how to do it properly. As the straggler, the sole member of the last row, I only had to follow along. Returned to our rooms, standing at our respective windowsills, Nigel and I made a decision. Something small and also big, which was to save our toffees for later, for Christmas. Was it pessimism or pragmatism that told us we weren't going home before then? I don't know, but the thought of it was so stark, so totally miserable, I figured we should at least prepare. I couldn't bear the idea that I'd be apart from my family for the holiday, stuck in a hot room with nothing but a mattress, a mosquito net, and a piece of brown linoleum, still enduring Abdullah's assaults, yet praying for a way out. Christmas was the one time of year when my brothers surfaced at home, when my grandparents and father and Perry congregated to eat my mother's roast turkey, when we took pictures and felt like a regular united family. As the day grew closer, it seemed certain that even in the wake of my near execution, there was to be no change in the stalemate between our captors and our governments or our captors and our families. Nigel and I started to make more plans. We had the toffees to begin with. I had stored mine in the lineup of care package treasures I kept next to my mattress, right next to my St. Ives body lotion. We agreed to exchange gifts and write stories for each other, stories of the best Christmases we'd ever spent, recorded in exacting, drawn-out detail, especially the parts about food. I worked hard on my story, pulling up long past memories of the Christmas my mom had surprised me with a trip to Disneyland. I wrote it all down for Nigel's benefit and for mine. For his gift, I chose a white hourglass-shaped plastic bottle of cough syrup that had come in the care package and painstakingly converted it into a little doll. I drew a smiling face on the top part and took one of my black socks and fashioned it into a tiny tailored sweater, complete with sleeves. I sliced up a Q-tip stick to serve as my needle and unwound strands of dental floss for thread. I used Nigel's beard trimmers, which he'd left at my request on the window ledge in the bathroom, to do the cutting. I embroidered three words, "My little buddy," on the front of the doll's sweater. I then made Nigel a Christmas card containing a pumped-up advertisement for his new toy. "Never feel alone again. Little buddy is here." Finally, I took out a blank sheet of paper and drew striped candy canes all over it, tucking Nigel's gift inside as if it were wrapping paper, securing the whole thing with more dental floss. I made him a stocking, using more paper, stitched together with more floss, and stuck my three toffees inside. On Christmas morning, somewhat brazenly, I walked down the hallway with a bulge under my dress and left it all on the high ledge in our bathroom. The gift, the stocking, even the full notebook containing my story. I knocked on the wall to tell Nigel to go get it. A while later, he knocked again, instructing me to retrieve some things he'd left for me, a wrapped gift and a decorated paper stocking with his toffees in it. We spent the morning singing carols. Hark the Herald Angels Sing, Joy to the World, things like that. We sucked our toffees down slowly, one after the other, until each became like a granule of sugar on the tongue. Nigel's story was about the Christmas when he and his siblings bought airplane tickets for their parents to go to Ireland. At our windows, we asked each other follow-up questions to drag the stories out. I loved him in that moment, on that day, more than I'd ever loved anyone, in a way that reached past the standard boy-girl love and hit some sort of deeper bedrock. I loved him as a human, with no complication. Blessedly, our captors left us alone. We sang Little Drummer Boy, and each of us throaty with emotion, we sang Silent Night. Finally, standing at his sill, Nigel opened his little buddy with an amused gasp, and then I was allowed to open my gift. For the stocking, he'd used red ballpoint ink to color two full notebook pages. He'd torn them into matching sock-shaped sides and then sewn them together with dental floss, adding a dried strip of a wet wipe to the top as a stand-in for white fur trim. Inside was a small box, the cardboard insert from a package of cologne Donald had brought Nigel months earlier, wrapped in hand-decorated paper. Inside the box was a delicate-looking bracelet he'd made for me, a chain of saved-up pop-tops from his old tuna cans, carefully and intricately strung together with threads and accessorized by colorful little tassels he'd pulled from the edges of his sarong, tying one to each link in the chain. It was clear he'd spent days putting it all together, using his fingertips to make knots the size of poppy seeds. It was done with care, made with exactly what he had. It was better than anything you'd find at Tiffany's. It was better, in that moment, than anything I'd ever received. Chapter 30. The Escape. Was there some way out? There had to be. In January, we started talking about trying to escape. It began one day when Nigel announced he'd been studying the window in the bathroom and thought we could climb through it. I, too, had looked at that window plenty of times. I saw no possibilities there. The window was about 8 feet off the bathroom floor, recessed far back in the thick wall up near the ceiling, with a ledge maybe 2 feet deep, almost like an alcove or a cubbyhole. What was at the end of that alcove hardly counted as a window. It was, rather, a screen made of bricks with a few decorative gaps in between them, serving as ventilation holes for the bathroom. The bricks were cemented together. And then, as if that weren't enough, laid horizontally in front of the bricks was a series of 5 metal bars anchored into the window frame. "Are you crazy?" I said to Nigel. "It's impossible. How would we get out?" "You should crawl up there," he said. "I've been looking at the bricks. The mortar is crumbling. We could dig it out." "Yeah, but the bars..." "I think I could pull them loose. They're not that secure." "I don't know," he said, sounding not entirely confident. "But I think it could work." I was doubtful. The idea was crazy for other reasons, the most obvious one being that if we were caught trying to escape, I felt sure our captors would either kill us or punish us in ways we didn't want to imagine. Besides that, having been driven out into the desert, I'd seen the outside world, our immediate surroundings, a landscape of big bonfires and young men wandering around with guns. If we were to run, it wasn't as if we were running toward any certain safety. Finally, too, there was the matter of the 3 Somali men being held captive with us, Abdi, Marwali, and Mahad, and what might happen to them if we got out. If we ran, I was convinced they'd be killed, and I could see no way that 5 of us would manage to escape together. I hardly knew the 3 Somalis, but I felt a sense of kinship with them and a responsibility for having gotten them captured in the first place. Whenever I was in the hallway, I found myself glancing in the direction of their door, where their shoes, 2 sets of sandals and a pair of Western-style hiking boots that belonged to Abdi, were always arranged in a neat line, presumably so they could slip into them when it was time to visit their bathroom outside. Every so often, I'd catch sight of one of them sitting there in the light, reading the Quran or sometimes stitching a piece of clothing. What I knew of them came only from these narrow glimpses and sounds that carried through the hallway and from what little we'd learned before being kidnapped. Abdi struck me as an earnest family man. Marwali, the driver from the Shamo Hotel, seemed more boisterous. I appreciated the sound of his laughter in the house. He seemed to chuckle easily and often, despite the circumstances. Mahad, who'd come from the medical clinic we'd been planning to visit on the day we were kidnapped, appeared to be extremely religious, loudly reciting verses from the Quran through much of the day. As we moved toward our 5th month of captivity, Jamal remained the best source of information on what was going on with our captors and our families back home. "Any news?" I asked one day as he carried in the morning bag of food. "There is no news," he said, shaking his head, adding with a sigh, "Inshallah, this is done soon." When I asked when the leaders would next visit, he pursed his lips, wearing an expression of slight distress. He said, "I don't know." They hadn't come in nearly a month. It was only through Jamal and his penchant to speak English, to linger and gossip in our rooms, that we knew the boys, to some degree, also felt like hostages, living as they were under the thumb of the captain and the group's increasingly invisible leaders. They were eating poorly, Jamal said. The guard named Yahya, who was no more than 18 or 19, had missed the birth of his first child earlier in the month, though Skids had granted him a few days' leave to go home for a visit. Jamal had appealed to take time off and marry Hamdi, but Skids had denied him, saying he had to wait until the ransom money came in and the program, all of them referred to our captivity as the program, was finished. We all wanted it to be soon, every last soul in the house. I fell asleep at night thinking, soon, and I woke up in the morning and called the word back, soon, soon. I believed it enough to think we shouldn't try to dig bricks out of the bathroom window, that we should trust soon was coming. Until one day, I stepped out into the hallway, headed toward the shower, and noticed a new quiet. It was January 14th, a Wednesday. The shoes outside Abdi, Marwali, and Mahad's door were gone, all three pairs. It appeared they'd been moved. My hope was that they'd been released, though I knew that was unlikely. Our captors wouldn't want three witnesses roaming free. A while later, I was able to ask Abdullah what had happened to our Somali colleagues. He didn't hesitate. Seeming pleased with himself, he lifted a finger to his throat and drew it in a straight line across. My mind flashed to the desert, to the lonely acacia tree under the moon. Had the leaders come in the middle of the night and taken them? How had I not heard anything? Was Abdullah telling the truth? When Nigel and I met up at the window, he said that he, too, had asked about the men's whereabouts. While Jamal had given a vague answer, suggesting that maybe they had been let go, Abdullah had made the same emphatic throat-slitting gesture. My stomach started to churn. The worst case seemed the most likely. The Somali guys had been killed. And it was our fault. Before we were captured, Abdi had proudly shown me pictures of his children, two boys and a girl, smiling little kids in school uniforms, who now, thanks to me, had no father. Every part of me felt weak. The disappearance of Abdi and the others told us something important about our captors. Money to feed and house our group seemed to be running out. Desperation was setting in. That they could kill their fellow Somalis, Muslim brothers, all three, didn't bode well for me and Nigel. There was no question in my mind. We had to get out. It took some effort to pull myself up to the window in the bathroom to check the possibilities. I had to stand with one foot planted on either side of the toilet seat, reaching up past my shoulders to get my hands on the ledge, and from there to boost myself up, as if levering my way out of a swimming pool. The alcove leading to the window was too shallow to hold all of me, so I leaned forward, holding my weight with my elbows, stomach balanced on the ledge, legs dangling heavily back toward the ground. With my chest pressed against the ledge and my face up close to the window, I could see instantly that Nigel was right. The bricks covering the opening were only loosely cemented. The mortar between them crumbled at my touch, coming away in small cascades of white dust. From my room, I brought my pair of nail clippers, and using the little knife-like apparatus meant to dig dirt from beneath the fingernails, I was able to reach between the metal bars blocking the window and poke into some of the deeper, rubbly spaces between the bricks, where I felt a promising bit of movement, the suggestion of bigger fault lines. With some diligent chipping, it seemed possible that we could remove a few rows of bricks, creating an opening just big enough to fit through. The bars over the bricks were another matter. They were about 3 feet long and appeared to be sunk deep into the walls on either side of the window, though I could see that Nigel had already managed to loosen one of them from its anchor points. He'd sworn to me that he could muscle at least one more out of its hold. Feeling elated, I dropped back to the bathroom floor, covered in grit and cobwebs. I hurried back to my room, for the first time in months not thinking about danger or hunger or worry, consumed instead by the idea that we could make a hole to the outside, a body-sized hole, and slip through it. Standing at our windows, we began to work on a plan. What time of day would we go? What would we bring? Which direction would we run? Who would we seek out, and what would we say? The considerations were enormous. We debated whether it would be best to escape at night, while most of the guards were asleep and we were less likely to cause a ruckus running down the street. Recalling the bonfires, I assumed night was a more dangerous time to be out. And maybe, too, we wanted to cause a ruckus. Maybe we needed to be loud and visible, forcing someone to call the authorities, whoever the authorities in these parts might be. Or did we find a sympathetic person and beg to use a cell phone, hoping he or she had enough calling credit to sustain a 1-minute call to Canada or Australia? or a cheaper call to Ajos whose number I had written on a hidden away scrap of paper, or to the Somali director of the World Food Program office in Mogadishu, whose number I'd also been carrying when we were first taken. Nigel and I agreed that we needed to put distance between us and our captors as quickly as possible and that we'd be well served by trying to blend in. For me, in an abaya and hijab, looking like any other woman on the street wouldn't be so hard. But there was no hiding Nigel's white skin. We considered whether I should loan him one of my Somali outfits and he could pose as a very tall woman, fully covered, but even my longest abaya would reach only halfway down his calves. We knew, too, that dressing Nigel in drag was the kind of thing that could backfire on us in the end. Every option we explored felt like a blind corner. Every idea seemed like a gamble, with myriad ways it could go awry. We spent many hours discussing the plan. All the while, we traded shifts in the bathroom, hauling ourselves onto the ledge with fingernail clippers in hand, chiseling at the window mortar in hurried 5 and 10 minute bursts. The work was gratifying, like surgery or digging for gold. Sometimes I'd grind and get dust. Other times, with some careful prying, I'd manage to extract a nice little slab of fully intact cement. Because my door was in easy sight of the veranda, I had to be more cautious, knocking for permission to leave my room, never staying too long in the bathroom, carefully brushing off all signs of white mortar dust before stepping back into the hallway. I also realized how frail I'd become, despite all the deliberate hours spent walking. Although my legs were strong, the muscles in my arms were wasted and wobbly. Midway through the second day, my elbow started to buckle every time I tried to pull myself up to the window ledge, and I had to give up. Nigel continued to work diligently. He was in a better position than I to make undetected trips to the bathroom. I kept watch through my keyhole, ready to create a distraction if any of the boys started heading his way. Using my medical phrase sheets, I cobbled together a little message and wrote the Somali words on a piece of paper to carry with me when we escaped, tucked in the front pocket of my jeans, which I'd wear beneath my black abaya. Please help. I am Muslim. Don't be afraid. I'd rehearsed the Somali syllables over and over, not 100% sure of what I was saying. On a separate tiny scrap of paper, I copied the few Somali phone numbers I had in my reporter's notebook, putting that in my pocket as well. Each time I visited the bathroom, I looked up at the window to track Nigel's progress. Though he was careful to cover his work, sliding each brick he'd removed back into place, tucking it in with stray nuggets of cement, you could see the disturbance, the skewed bricks and mounds of loose mortar sitting on the sill. I tried to take solace in the knowledge that the boys walked into our bathroom only once or twice a week, mainly to take the oversized bucket we used for water and refill it. But still, the risk we were taking felt suddenly huge. Since Abdi and the others had disappeared, I'd felt too stressed to eat much, and now my stomach went into a full clench. On the start of the third day, Nigel declared that he'd carved out the final brick. He now had to contend with the metal bars, but he already had that first one loose and thought it would take only one more to create enough space to pass through. First, though, we had to recommit ourselves to escaping. Once he yanked out the two bars, the side walls would likely collapse. There would be no masking the rubble in the bathroom. We'd really have no choice but to run. We decided that we should make our break that same night, slipping out the window at about 8 p.m., just after the evening's final prayer. We had hardly slept in 3 days, hopped up on the perpetual buzz of adrenaline. It seemed pointless to wait any longer. I was worried that if we did, our nerves would give us away. We hoped that the darkness would serve as some sort of camouflage. We tried to disguise Nigel as a sick person, an old man, draping a sheet over his head to cover his skin, wrapping his shoulders in a blanket that would hide his hands. I'd pretend to be guiding him, burying my hands in the folds of the same blanket. Both of us would hunch deliberately, with our faces cast down as if hurrying to a doctor. We'd carry a Quran in my little backpack to prove we were Muslim, that we weren't enemies. We'd look for a door to knock on.